Hello and welcome to the How To Academy podcast, the bi-weekly show from London's home of big thinking. I'm Vas Christodoulou. Amitav Ghosh is a novelist whose new non-fiction book, Smoke and Ashes, reveals the rarely told true history of opium and its role in shaping capitalism, from the Enlightenment all the way to the present day. It's as shocking and powerful a piece of historical writing as you'll read all year, and Amy Morris sat down with Amitav last week to find out more. When we recorded this podcast, there was some drilling in the background from the building next door. Not ideal ambience for podcasting, but do stick with us. It's a great interview in spite of the noise, I promise.
Amitav, you've written a trilogy of historical novels about the 19th century opium trade. What compelled you to write a non-fiction account of the history in Smoke and Ashes?
Well, my trilogy, the Ibis trilogy, it's called, the three novels that I wrote, it didn't begin with being about the opium trade at all. I was really interested in the traffic in indentured labor, in the 1830s, starting in the 1830s onwards, after slavery was banned in the British colonies. They really substituted indentured labor, So a lot of workers left India under the indenture, went to places like Mauritius and the Caribbean and so on. And this was my real interest to start with. And I was sort of interested in writing also about the Indian Ocean and, So that's how I began. But then, the great discovery that came to me, and honestly, it was just a complete surprise to me as well, the discovery that really the most important trade in the Indian Ocean in the 19th century was the opium trade. Huge amounts of opium going from India to China, and China sending tea to Britain. So that's how it began. And then once I got into it, I became quite immersed in the whole, in the opium trade. Because, I was a student of history in university. And I had no idea of how big the opium trade was and how profoundly it's affected Indian history, but also British history. Indeed, the history of the whole world. The opium trade was, in many ways, it laid the foundations of modern capitalism.
And the history has personal relevance to you and your family as well, doesn't it?
Yes. Because my family was displaced from their ancestral village in what is now Bangladesh in the 1850s by a big flood. That's a very common thing that happens there. Rivers change course. People, are flooded often. But what happened with my family is they started moving westwards along the rivers, and they finally settled in Bihar, in a small town called Chhapra. I don't know why they settled there. I used to be really sort of puzzled by this, because this was an obscure little town. I can't say obscure little town. I mean, it was important. It was an important regional town, but it wasn't like the biggest city in that in that area or anything like that. So I often wondered why they settled there. And then, it was while writing this book that it really occurred to me that the reason they settled there was because this was a very important node in the opium trade. It was the capital of the biggest sort of opium poppy growing region in Bihar. So that must have had something to do with it, because that was the economy that existed there. So somehow, even if they weren't working directly, within the opium cultivation regime, opium laid the background for it.
You mentioned tea earlier, and in fact, you have a cup of tea in front of you now. Can you tell us about the epiphany you had around tea and how tea was instrumental in the colonial opium trade?
Yes, certainly. Well, what happened, in the 17th century, tea became very, very important for the British economy. It was the second largest source of revenue for Britain, Tea was taxed at very, very high rates, sometimes as much as 100%. Whereas the Chinese actually had only 10% taxes on tea. So tea was actually more lucrative for Britain than it was for China. But simply because it was such an important pillar of the British economy, the British economy became almost dependent on tea and on the tea trade. Now, the problem with this was that the Chinese were happy to export as much tea as Britain wanted. But in exchange for that, they would only accept silver, you know. And for a while, this worked very well because a lot of silver from South America was entering Europe and the global economy. So there was plenty of silver to trade. But in the 18th century, there was a sort of big disruption in supplies of silver. And it became harder and harder for Britain to find the bullion to trade with in China. So at that point, they started looking for some other commodity to exchange in China. And this was very difficult because the Chinese weren't really interested in European goods. I mean, what were they going to do with wool, for example? It wasn't useful for them. So, the British racked their brains and they thought, well, there's one commodity for which there's a small market in China. And that's Indian opium produced in India. And opium was produced in India mainly as a medicinal substance, you know. But long before the British started doing this, the Dutch had actually pioneered the opium trade, in Southeast Asia. And they had grown the market for opium phenomenally in Southeast Asia. And the British were perfectly aware of this because, they had very close relations with the Dutch and so on.
Frenemies,
yes. So they knew that they could that this was a market that was very, very elastic. It could grow very fast. So they started exporting opium to China, and it completely served its purpose. Within a few decades, it was China that was losing huge quantities of silver to Britain.
And how did the Europeans justify what was essentially the world's first drug cartel?
Basically they did it with racialized arguments. They said these are degenerate Asians. This is an Asian tradition, even though the Chinese had banned opium as early as 1729. In fact, it was a completely foreign thing, the introduction of opium. It was introduced in this large scale by Europeans.
So there wasn't this insatiable demand for the drug that was simply there to be met.
Not at all. I mean, that was the kind of argument that they made, that, we are just, there's a huge demand and we are just creating the supply. If we don't, someone else will. But it wasn't like that at all. In fact, they grew the market.
How were Enlightenment concepts like free trade used in this myth-making around the opium trade?
Oh, they were absolutely crucial. You have to remember that, Adam Smith, David Ricardo, etc., they were writing their works, their theoretical works in the late 18th century. And in fact, a lot of the traders, the opium traders, were Scottish. Many of them had actually been students of Adam Smith and so on. So these ideas about free trade, about an equilibrium between supply and demand, very powerfully influenced their thinking. And in fact, that was the entire justification for the opium, one of the major justifications of the opium trade, which is that they said, oh, there's a supply, there's a demand, so supply has to be created, And actually, this is one of the strange myths of modernity, this idea that it's always demand that leads to supply, because it doesn't work like that at all. For example, in the US in the 90s, the Sackler family decided, in fact, to create this drug called OxyContin. It was an opioid. And one of the Sacklers actually said, you don't chase a market, you create a market. And that's actually how any kind of trade in addictive substances always works. So, the Sacklers, essentially in 6 years, they made this vast fortune by marketing OxyContin especially in Appalachia and other rural parts of the United States. So it's really a kind of predatory practice. But the Sacklers again said a demand exists. Yet we know that before the Sacklers introduced OxyContin, there was no opioid crisis in America. But after they did, the opioid crisis took off, and it's proved to be unstoppable. You know, every year the number of opioid deaths keeps going up and up and up. I mean, everyone thought that it had peaked during the pandemic, but that's not proved to be the case. It keeps going up.
I want to talk a bit more about the Americans. Obviously, opium fortunes were being made on both sides of the Atlantic over the course of the 19th century. But how was that wealth particularly transformative for the United States at the time?
Well, you have to remember that at the time of independence for the United States in 1783, they were kind of isolated. You know, the British Empire was all around it, and the British Empire wouldn't trade with the United States. And the United States suddenly realized that they had to trade with China. Before that, they couldn't trade with China because the East India Company had a monopoly. You know, and the Americans weren't allowed to trade with China. But in 1783, just weeks after the last British ships left New York, a ship set out to go to China. It was actually called the Empress of China. You know, immediately they found themselves welcomed. They found a huge new source of trade revenue. And many sort of prominent Americans said that we have to develop this channel of trade. So in the beginning, you know, they faced the same problem that the British faced, which is that you know, they wanted a lot of Chinese goods, but the Chinese, they had nothing to sell to the Chinese. You know, there was a demand for fur. So, you know, John Jacob Astor, the founder of the first sort of mega fortune in America, he made his initial fortune in furs. You know, so he started taking some furs to China. And initially there was a market, but the market for furs is not a very elastic market. So that, you know, the demand was soon saturated. Then they started selling other things like sea cucumbers and sandalwood, you know, various sorts of rarities and so on. But again, you know, they understood, they knew perfectly well that the real money lay in opium, because that's what the British were doing. So the Americans became great innovators. They developed a new supply route for opium from Turkey. And they quickly became completely dominant in the Turkish market, and they started sending very large quantities of opium from Turkey to China. But Turkey simply couldn't match, you know, the amount of supply that came from India. So then the Americans started developing their connections with India, and they made phenomenal fortunes, you know. It was actually a very small group of families, mainly from New England, and very tightly knit. And these were the families that we now know as the Boston Brahmins, many of the most prominent families in America. You know, the Coolidges, you know, Cabots, many, many other families, very well-known families from Boston. But the most interesting aspect of this, perhaps, the family of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. His grandfather was in fact the biggest opium trader in China in the mid 19th century. In fact, their family money came largely from opium. But what was interesting about these young traders is that they would go to China when they were very young. I mean, there was a man called John Cushing, for example, who was also related to this whole network of families, and he went as a 16-year-old boy. And fortunately for him, a very senior Chinese merchant sort of adopted him. And within a few years, he went back to America as more or less the richest man in northeastern America. So, but when these great American tycoons went back, you know, they had a lot of money with them. They had capital, but they were also young. you know, in their 20s. They were very dynamic. And what their experience of China helped them discover, actually, was a certain kind of cosmopolitan worldview, a globalized worldview. They suddenly understood, you know, credit mechanisms. They understood what the kinds of new industries were developing in, you know, in Europe. So they went back to America and they became pioneers of the American economy. Many of them invested very heavily in railroads. So, you know, the early American railroads were largely funded by opium money.
Wow. And there are more towns in the U.S. named after Canton, aren't there, than there
yes.
are after London or any other European
yes.
capital as a result.
It's an astonishing thing, you know. I mean, there are so many towns named after Canton. But these towns are almost always at railroad junctions, you know.
And how has this opium wealth seeped down through the generations, through philanthropic activity and sort of big U.S. institutions?
Well, this is a sort of constant feature of the opium trade, that people who made a lot of money in opium, they all became great philanthropists, you know, giving away lots and lots of money to educational institutions and so on. So every major Ivy League university actually has a lot of opium money in there, you know. But not just them, it's also museums, hospitals, asylums, all kinds of welfare institutions were founded with opium money. And, you know, their endowments had, you know, huge injections of opium money. So everywhere you look in Northeastern America, really, at any public institution, you can be sure that there's some opium money in there. The most prominent building at Columbia University in New York is called the Lowe Library. It's a very grand building. It's sort of iconic of Columbia, you know. And that's named after a very big opium trader called Abel Abbott Lowe. But the curious thing is that the people in Columbia didn't know this. Even the historians didn't know. So they invited me to go and talk to them about it, and I did. And, you know, they seemed to be kind of amazed. But, you know, it's an astonishing story, really.
This episode of the podcast is sponsored by Marquee TV. Marquee TV is an incredible streaming service that is a gateway to arts and culture. With my subscription, I've enjoyed watching some of the Royal Shakespeare Company's most acclaimed productions of recent years, including David Tennant in Richard II and Simon Russell Beale in The Tempest. I've seen multiple productions of The Ring Cycle and Thelonious Monk playing in Brussels in 1963. I've watched Alice in Wonderland at the Royal Opera House and Giselle at La Scala. Marquee TV really is the most accessible way into culture I've ever encountered, and a treasure trove for any arts lover. You can try it for 3 months for just 99p. Yep, 3 months for 99p with the code HOWTO. Just visit marquee.tv and use the promo code HOWTO to dive into the world of the arts like never before.
Hey there, I'm Dr. Maya Shankar, and I'm a scientist who studies human behavior. Many of us have experienced a moment in our lives that changes everything, that instantly divides our life into a before and an after. On my podcast, A Slight Change of Plans, I talk to people about navigating these moments. Their stories are full of candor and hard-won wisdom. And you'll hear from scientists who teach us how we can be more resilient in the face of change. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And how did the American merchants try to replicate the life that they'd had in China in the U.S.? And what kind of influences can we still see that sort of hark back to their time as traders?
Yeah, that's another really interesting thing. You know, we always think of a sort of lifestyles of the wealthy as something that comes out of, say, England or Europe or whatever. But in fact, China had a profound influence on the lifestyles of these traders. When they went back to America, you know, what they observed while they were in China was the lifestyle of wealthy Chinese And these were some of the richest men in the world. So these wealthy Chinese merchants, they would create these huge estates. They collected, most of all, they were very interested in gardening. They collected a lot of flowers and plants and so on. So these merchants, these American and British merchants, when they observed the lifestyles of the Chinese, when they went back home, they tried to replicate it. So many of them had huge collections of chinoiserie. Many of them invested heavily in gardens and in flowering plants of various kinds. And actually, the rise of yachting in America, for example, can be directly traced back to their experience of life in China. So in many of those ways, you see how these traditions came to be passed down. And that's the curious thing, that they are now regarded as being entirely WASP, you know. But in fact, you know, they were heavily influenced by Chinese lifestyles and so on.
And what was life like for the British opium agents once the opium department had been established in India? What were their lifestyles like at that time?
I think they must have been extraordinarily grim because, you know, they had to live in small villages in Bihar and, you know, just really small towns which had very little to offer them. And at the same time, you know, they were enforcing a really horrible system, you know, where they were essentially forcing vast numbers of peasants to produce opium below cost. This is what they were doing. These peasants, you know, impoverished farmers. In any case, they were having to produce all this opium for their masters. So, you know, they lived under constant threat. Many of them slept with their revolvers under their pillows. Perhaps the best known of all the opium agents is the father of George Orwell. You know, he was an opium agent. George Orwell was born in the heart of the opium country in Motihari in Bihar. But I think it's all these conditions that really weighed upon the family. So his father sent his mother and his siblings back to England, you know, where they were actually kind of rather impoverished, you know, but they managed to, you know, send Eric Blair or George Orwell to very good schools. But I think it must have been, for the lower categories of agents, it must have been very difficult. But then you also had the opium agent himself was a very grand man, you know. It was one of the most prized jobs in the Indian bureaucracy because he was paid an enormous amount. And he had this vast kind of a lifestyle, you know, with grand houses, thousands of retainers. And, you know, they would go on these tours, you know, with literally like thousands of retainers accompanying them. So, you know, that was another aspect of it as well.
And how did structural differences within the opium trade across Western and Eastern India set those regions on very different historical paths?
Well, you know, this is one of those sort of accidents of history, because the chronology of the British expansion in India was such that they began to expand most aggressively in Eastern India. And by 1763, they had really conquered, you know, the main opium-producing region. In Western India, they were not quite so successful because Western India had some very powerful Maratha states which resisted quite effectively, you know, and were never really they were never really beaten down in the way that the indigenous states of Eastern India were. So what happened is that there was a complete sort of divergence in the opium economies of the two of Eastern and Western India. Within Eastern India, opium was completely a state monopoly. Every aspect of the opium trade was a state monopoly of the East, first the East India Company, later the British Raj. But in Western India, it was various indigenous states that were managing the opium economy, with the result that the money that came from opium really percolated downwards. You know, I mean, even the peasants profited from it, but most of all, the merchants and the merchant networks profited hugely from it. So there was a lot more capital in indigenous hands. And also, traders, Indian traders like Parsi traders got to travel to China. And they, there again, like their American counterparts, they became very sort of cognizant of the emerging global economy. So actually, Parsi merchants became pioneers in Indian industry. They founded every major industry in India. And in fact, one of those families, the Tatas, is now the largest employer in Britain.
I like the way you describe the trading activities in Western and Central India as proto-Bloombergian. In what way was the marketplace modern in that way?
Well, it's actually not so much in Western India. I think I said that in relation to Eastern India, because what happened was that the price of opium would be set at the opium auctions, fortnightly opium auctions in Calcutta, you know. But people, you know, if you look up the history of the futures markets, for example, they'll tell you that futures markets began in Chicago in the mid-19th century. But in fact, in India, merchants had futures markets long, long before that, for hundreds of years before that. So opium also got sort of integrated into this whole network of futures markets. So as soon as the auction results came out, they would send off these messengers, you know, sort of racing off across the land. They would send off pigeons and so on. They had very sort of elaborate systems of information. So, you know, the big Indian opium merchants were actually in Western India. And they would immediately find out what the price level was in Calcutta, and they would start manipulating the markets. They would start speculating in opium futures and so on. And they made vast fortunes.
You draw an interesting parallel between the opium trade of the 19th century and our current energy crisis and our dependence on fossil fuels. Can you elaborate on the connection that you see between the two?
Well, let me put it like this, that, you know, energy corporations today are some of the most, perhaps the most powerful entities in the world. You know, I mean, energy is at the heart of every major conflict in the 20th century, and it continues to be the case into this day. So fossil fuels, you know, basically. In the 19th century, opium was similarly an enormous strategic reserve. You know, but you have to remember that the sponsors of the opium trade were, again, the most powerful entities in the world, which is the Dutch, British, and French empires. You know, all of them were making huge profits from opium. So they were defending the opium trade. Now, you know, obviously in England, in America, in China, in India, all around the world, there was emerging a kind of opposition movement, you know, to the opium trade. And when that happened, the way that the British Empire, which really took the lead in this, the way that the British Empire defended the opium trade was, again, by creating all these forms of denial that have, you know, these tactics that would later be adopted by, say, the tobacco industry, and have now, these tactics have also now been adopted by energy corporations, you know, for example, saying, "Oh, it's the demand, not the supply," or you know, so they created all these arguments, you know, placing the blame on the consumer rather than on the supplier. This goes back really a very long way, the use of these kinds of tactics. But what is interesting is that finally, the anti-opium movement came together in such a way that they were able to prevail against the empires. And I think if such a movement were to arise today, maybe they could prevail against energy corporations.
So as bleak as the history is that you set out, there is an offering of hope.
I hope so. Yes. I mean, at least it's possible.
At some point, you decided to abandon this project. I think you went so far as to cancel your contract with the publisher. You returned your advances. What then changed your mind? Why did you continue?
You know, I started writing this book way back after I finished the Ibis trilogy because I had this huge amount of research material. So I felt I should do something with it. And I started writing it, but so I even got a contract. I had advances from my publishers and so on. But halfway through, I just couldn't take it anymore because it's such a grim story, you know. It's such a grim, hard, and difficult story. And I just couldn't go on with it. I thought to myself, I've lived with this subject for years already, and I just can't go on. So I stopped working on it. I returned the money to my publishers, created a lot of trouble for myself, for my agents, etc. But then after I finished my last couple of books, which have mainly been about, as it were, the planetary crisis of today, one way or the other, and they were nonfiction books, suddenly I could see so many parallels. And most of all, I felt the story has to be told, you know, people need to know. Because one of the problems that have created, our current crisis is, of course, this unfettered capitalism, you know. And the reason that capitalism can run riot in this way is because there's a lot of myth-making around capitalism. You know, that it was heroic virtue, individualism, this and that. But, you know, that wasn't the case. I mean, capitalism arose out of things like the opium trade. I mean, so many of the institutions of capitalism were literally invented in the course of the opium trade. Modern globalization emerges out of the opium trade. I mean, one of the most important, the biggest port in the world is what? I think it's Shanghai. Hong Kong is another. Singapore is another. Bombay is another. All of these ports were essentially nodes in the opium trade. That's what sustained them. You know, I mean, the reason that Singapore could be a free port is because 50% of its revenues came from opium. So, you know, I think it's a really a terrible thing that, these histories aren't taken account of.
And perhaps there's a learning around the humility that we should have as human beings in the face of these very powerful earthly forces.
Absolutely. Again, that's absolutely the case. I mean, this whole sort, I mean, the reason that the British and the Dutch started trading in opium in such a big way is because they actually persuaded themselves that white people could never be addicts or could never be drug addicts, you know. They literally persuaded themselves of this. I mean, in the 1890s, they did a survey with a lot of British officials, and all the officials say this, no, you know, white man will never take opium. And, they really persuaded themselves of all these bizarre myths. And, now we see what's happening. I would say that today the West, the collective West, is living through the same kind of cultural trauma that China lived through in the 19th century, you know.
Well, thank you for joining us, Amitav.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Amy. Thank you for having me.
This episode starred Amitav Ghosh and was presented by Amy Morris. It was produced by me, and I make the series with Nicole Wong. Our editor, John Doughty, did his darndest to dial down those drills. Till next time, I'm Vas Christodoulou. Thanks for listening.